Hello and welcome to Criterion Close-Up. This is Aaron West, and you're probably wondering why you're hearing my voice before the music of the episode. Unfortunately, this is the technical difficulties episode of our series. It's the first out of our first 10 episodes, hopefully the last. You're going to find that in the first segment, my mic had some issues. And in the second segment, we got about 4 minutes in and lost the entire track. It was tempting to just scrap this episode. Unfortunately, Mark and Keith are no longer available to re-record it. But the thing is, it was a great episode. Keith was a fantastic guest. In fact, one of my favorite guests, and I welcome him back anytime. We had tremendous rapport, and we laughed a ton during House. We just had a whole lot of fun recording it. And when we get to that point, I will kind of summarize the discussion as much as I can. But unfortunately, aside for those first 4 minutes, it is lost. We do have the Shining discussion, and we think that is good enough to at least put the episode out, along with, of course, the news. As I mentioned, my microphone on the first segment had some errors, so this was a learning experience for all of us. But we think the content is good enough at least to release something. Maybe one day we'll do another little splinter episode of House to do it justice, because we think it is an important movie, and we did like it in various ways. We did find it worthwhile. So please enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Criterion
Close-Up.
This is episode 10. We're on 10 double-digit episodes, Aaron. What do you think?
It's unbelievable.
Wow, yeah.
One has not gone to 11 yet.
Next episode, we'll hit 11. So this week, we're going to be talking about the great horror film from 1977, House.
House.
It's by Nobuhiko Obayashi. I hope I said that correctly. And then we are going to be talking about what might be the ultimate haunted house film in Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. So we were talking about haunted house movies, and we were going to talk about some different ones, but why not just spend a little time on the granddaddy of them all, The Shining. So this is going to be a visual episode. We're going to have lots of clips, and there will be many images on the blog post, as you might imagine, for movies like House and The Shining. So there'll be lots of tweets and YouTubes there. And also want to mention that we'll be censoring ourselves a little bit.
House.
House.
Hard to talk about these movies a little bit without saying some swear words, so if you hear a house in there, that's our bleeping for this episode.
House.
So we want to welcome our esteemed guest. Today we have, first time on the show, Mr. Keith Silva. Hello, Keith, and happy birthday.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Mark. It's nice to be here. And a first for our Criterion Close-Up, since we are recording side-by-side.
Yes.
In real life. I know you guys live in virtual life on Skype. But this
that's
is
true.
Real life.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, there was,
people don't know.
There was one time I was recording with Mark, and you walked up behind him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So we heard your footsteps, the footsteps of Keith.
Right.
So I was just watching, and I was like, who is that person?
We should have him on the show. He walks very well.
That's how it worked.
Yeah, that's
how it works. I like his style.
Right. People don't know. I mean, of course, Aaron's in South Carolina. I'm in Vermont, and Keith lives just down the road from me, about a quarter mile. So it's fun to
podcast on the other side of the tracks.
That's right. There are real railroad tracks.
Real tracks. Yeah.
So I wanted to just, you know, introduce Keith. Keith is someone I consider a friend, of course, and also a mentor when it comes to the Criterion Thanks. Collection. I credit him with introducing me both to Criterion and podcasting, so go figure. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Keith.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. Those are big shoes to fill.
Wow.
And your mom, too, of course. Your mom and Keith.
My mom? What did she have to do with this?
And also, our daughters actually share the exact same birthday. So, as far as kids go, it's a cool thing.
Happy birthday, Keith. I'm glad that you shared it with us.
Yes, thank you very much.
I'm not going to sing for you.
Please don't do that.
You don't want me to, trust me.
Maybe you can sing the house song. But...
The house song.
So, Keith, and again, really happy to have you here. And can you just talk a little bit about some of your work online? You have your fingers in many different items. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. And thank you both for having me on. I was really excited, Mark. I think we've talked about this a lot, but just so everybody else knows out there, really glad that you guys are doing this. And it's been great. I'm a downloader. I'm a listener of Criterion Close Up. So you guys are doing a great job. So I'm
thank you.
Happy to be on so early into your esteemed tenures here.
Nice. pun intended, tenure.
Very nice. Very nice. For the last few years, I've been doing a lot of writing for comicsbulletin.com. I mostly write about comics, but also pop culture and movies. There's a site, used to be part of Comics Bulletin. It's called Psycho Drive-In, and that's where I do a lot more pop culture film writing. I've written about House for last year's ABCs of Horror, which was a lot of fun, and this is a movie that is fun to talk about, fun to write about. I also have my own blog called Interested in Sophisticated Fun, which I'm trying to put a lot more of my stuff on there. I'm not so prolific. I get a lot of online because you should write more. I'm like, there should be more hours in the day.
Yes,
there should. But anyhow, that's what I've been doing. Interested in Sophisticated Fun, Comics Bulletin. Read a lot about comics, as I said. So why am I on this podcast? I know you.
That's right.
And we will put links in the show notes so people don't have to write all that down.
Oh, thank God.
And you're also, for your real job, you're a videographer.
I am an associate producer. Thank you very much.
All right.
Wow. Yes. For the last 20 years.
Sounds right.
Yeah, 25, actually. 20 years. I've been working for the University of Vermont Extension on a television program called Across the Fence. And I am a photographer, videographer, editor, reporter, producer. It's a very small shop.
You have many hats.
I wear all the hats. Yes.
Cool. Nice. Well, really excited to have you on, Keith. Thank you.
Great.
So Keith, thanks for introducing yourself. And as we've been having guests lately, we want to hear what folks' Criterion connection is to the Criterion collection. So how about you?
My Criterion story, I think it started shortly after I got a DVD player. I became obsessed with director's commentaries and extras. It was the one thing you could never get on VHS tapes. And so I was constantly trying to find out who has the best commentaries, who has the best extras and things like that. And guess what bubbled to the top? The Criterion collection. Go figure. My first Criterion was Silence of the Lambs. Spine number 13.
Nice.
For those of you out there keeping track.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting. I was actually looking up that there was a standard edition of Silence of the Lambs, a DVD. And for some reason, I thought, why spend 20 when you can spend $40 and read about serial killers? So
That's why he's here, folks.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. I also want to give a shout out to Criterion Confessions, which is a great blog. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it.
Yep.
It's run by Jamie S. Rich.
Yes.
Jamie is actually has a big foot in the comics world. He works for Vertigo right now, which is the imprint of the creator-owned imprint of DC. And I read Jamie's column on Criterion Confessions long before I read his comics. So shout out to Jamie. That's really cool. And Aaron, I wouldn't feel right being on the show without telling you my first Criterion was Silence of the Lambs. My second was The Third Man. So the original,
nice.
Not the remastered one. Mm-hmm. So I should have sold high when that was out of print for whatever, $5 million.
Right.
Now it's worth nothing.
You'd be a rich man.
Yes, yes.
No, it's still worth
something.
And by the way, we actually link to Criterion Confessions.
Oh, cool.
So
very cool.
Yeah, without knowing the connection.
Hey, how about that? So yeah, I'm not. So I guess if I'm gonna say anything about my Criterion-ness, I am definitely not as obsessed as some or all the guests you have on this show. But when I do buy Blu-rays, it is Criterion. So thank you for having some of the great unwashed of us, you know, other schmoes.
The schmoes on the show.
Have a complete Criterion collection on. So I'm holding it up for those guys. One of the things I enjoy is twice a year, not more than twice a year, but is going to Barnes & Noble with Mark and watching him buy every Criterion under the sun, and I buy like one or two. I have tried to convince him, Aaron, you might want to work on this or possibly an upcoming episode, is Mark still won't buy the Night Porter, and I don't know how he plans on being a Criterion completist without owning the Night Porter.
I now own the Night Porter.
Oh, my
okay,
God.
I thought this was a big secret.
Oh, boy.
Now, yeah.
I'm smelling podcast, a return for Keith.
One of the things that is great about the Criterion Collection, I've heard you guys say it a lot, is the film School in a Box. I am a hardcore blind buy Criterion guy, and I think that used to scare Mark back in the day. He has since gotten over that. Yeah,
completely over it.
Oh, completely over it. So yeah, I learned about things like the Samurai trilogy when it was a 3-disc box set, and Antoine Dwinel collection, and Cassavetes. I heard about this guy, you know, John Cassavetes, and just bought that collection. So I mean, you know, Criterion is definitely. It's film school in a box. It's just a great place to learn and to sort of follow things back. When I was, you know, learning about music growing up, I would always be like, okay, you know, the Led Zeppelin talked about, you know, this blues guy, Furry Lewis. Who the hell's Furry Lewis? And I go back and look up all these people. Furry Lewis was actually a Rolling Stones. I'm crossing the streams there.
That's okay.
That's fine.
But I guess so. What I'm going to have to do is buy the Apu trilogy, since I've never seen that, and it's the official Criterion movie of Criterion Close-Up, because you only mentioned it, I think, 10 out of 10 shows now.
Oh, so, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Really?
So I'll have to get that. Mark says it's not a Keith movie. What did you say? Was it miserable enough for me? Or
well, there's plenty of misery, and it is actually short enough for you. But I just think it's probably too slow.
Yes, man. When it comes to Criterion Collection, it's Armageddon or nothing.
it's no House. That's for sure.
Right.
What is?
Yeah. Exactly.
So thanks, Keith. That was great. I should mention too that you know, Keith of course introduced me to Jules and Jim originally, and he followed that up with the Antoine Dwinel series. So I've been doing well with by Keith as far as Criterion goes.
Such good taste I have.
You do.
Excellent taste.
And of course he was across the pond, so he could just, you know, lend me the discs. Right. So thanks again, Keith. We also, talking about thanks, we also want to thank David Blakesley again for joining us last week on our Moonrise Kingdom and Wes Anderson debate episode. We had a great time talking with him. He is awesome, as you guys know. And we
huge
also had a,
thanks, yeah, huge.
Thank you.
It was a great episode. Very
thank
good.
You.
I got to listen to that.
He thanks, is Keith. The man, yeah. Thanks, David.
And we had a lot of good response there. I mean, various responses about Wes Anderson films. I mean, we talked about how some folks enjoy the later stuff. Some folks are more still love Bottle Rocket and Rushmore the best. And that came through in some of the feedback. You know, we thought that was kind of the case. And some folks said that. Yeah. And it was great. I mean, I think we've got some new listeners we saw. It's our second most downloaded episode next to the Geek Fest. So, yeah, it's really a lot of fun. We also want to thank Peter Putzel, I believe it is, P-U-T-Z-E-L. He had mentioned on Twitter that one of the questions we had was, what is Wes's next project? And lo and behold, it looks like it's going to be and this is per a Slate article that we'll link to, it's a stop-motion dog movie.
Just as we predicted.
Yeah. Well, we did say it could be stop-motion, but we didn't really mention dogs. I think... Aaron, you were kind of hoping for a return to Fantastic Mr. Fox. So I was,
and I'm very enthused by this news. Yeah. So thank you, Peter, and now it's everywhere. So
right. Apparently it's in pre-production. It will, and just it's worth noting per the article, it will not be the Vittorio De Sica inspired anthology film. which Anderson has been attached to. So you'll just have to wait for your Italian neorealism from Wes Anderson. So, and just some housekeeping things, some things with the show. Aaron, the Facebook page looks a little different.
Yeah, we changed a few things, and that's one thing. The lines were kind of blurred between my blog and this project, and as this has developed, we've kind of leaned more towards this project. So we revamped the Facebook page to Criterion Close Up, so it's rebranded. There's actually, it used to be facebook.com/CriterionBlues, but now it's facebook.com/CriterionCloseUp. So gotten a lot of new likes. I think the Wes Anderson episode helped with that. I'm no longer giving out a dime to every one of them. That just got overwhelming for me.
Breaking the bank, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, so in case anybody wants to follow along with the podcast, and of course my blog stuff is still going to be around, and I'll still post updates there, but that's really the central home of me and Mark, and occasionally Keith.
Sure.
That's right. So, and as far as that, we're actually changing the quote-unquote responsibilities a little bit. We've been kind of kicking back and forth the hosting responsibilities, and you might have noticed I've been the host on the last couple shows, so... Aaron's been doing a lot of the production work anyway. He's been doing the editing. So he's going to be the Criterion Close-Up producer, wear that hat. And I'm going to be generally the host, so the person that kind of intros us and keeps things going. So it's a separation of duties, kind of.
Yeah, I don't have that big booming voice that Mark has. So it's also that I just don't like hosting, and I think you're good at it, so... No. But I like coming up with episodes and outlines and that sort of thing. So
right.
Golf clap.
And you're a great editor, so yeah.
Well,
so I mean, at this point, that's what we're doing. And so, and lastly, in the housekeeping pieces, we have a little thing to talk about. We have some Splinter episodes coming up that we're going to be calling Criterion
Shortcuts.
So. Some mini episodes, you know, we're thinking about just a single film, probably 30 minutes takes. And yeah, that's why we're calling it Shortcuts, you know, ones that won't be part of the main episode.
Yeah. And again, how my blogging has evolved to podcasting. And of course, I'm still going to blog. In fact, I'm going to put up a blog this week. But sometimes it's just easier to I found I enjoy podcasting about a film. It's easier to kind of process thoughts. So we'll do some short takes. Some of these will have Mark, some of these won't. We have other guests. I should let people know that I'm actually dealing with an injury right now. So over the next 3 months, until I have surgery, I'm going to probably be more prolific than Mark is. But it also gives us flexibility going forward. You know, we've done a few big episodes on directors, and we mentioned, well, you know, how do we tackle somebody like Godard? He has, you know, or actually Bergman's a better example. He has how many movies in the collection? Really all of them almost.
Right.
So we could do, Mark and I could do close-up episodes for like, you know, Winter Light, Silence, The Magician, and then maybe a big episode on, say, Seventh Seal, and then a sub-episode on Bergman, and kind of refer to all those, kind of build to that big episode and refer to the Shortcuts. So it'll be a separate series than close-up, you know, next close-up will be 11, which will be next week, and Shortcuts 1 will be probably maybe next week, if not the week after, probably.
Yeah, so more to come on that. So yeah, that's up. That's it for housekeeping. I just mentioned, you know, more content. So I hope people seem to like the length of the show and asking for more. So we're delivering, I guess.
And sometimes people ask for shorter, and so they're getting a little of both.
Right.
They're getting
right.
Shorter, longer, and people don't have to watch along. I'm not going to spoil anything on these episodes. So, yeah. You know, it's more strict reviews, 20, 30, maybe sometimes 40 minutes. So,
cool. So we have a few news items to talk about coming up this Thursday on the 15th, of course, 15th of the month. Very exciting for people. We've got the January releases that will be announced, hopefully on the 15th. So mm-hmm. We're thinking we should probably talk about some predictions. Keith, what do you think might come out in
January?
Isn't
January usually a light month? They don't usually do too much in January. I can't,
depends.
I can't remember.
The one I thought of was I think Safe, if I remember, came out either, actually, I think it was February.
December, actually.
Oh, it was December. Okay. Yeah, so yeah. There's your light month. Mm-hmm. The one thing I was thinking is probably no box sets would be my guess, although you never know. So
January can be a pretty good month, but again, no box sets, but probably some good titles.
Well, so. I don't know if this is a very good prediction, but I know one thing at the top of my list for Criterion. I'm going to make a it's a wish prediction.
A wish list. Yeah.
It's a wish prediction.
That's fine. Yeah.
The movie that's been out of print. Criterion's got a couple Robert Redford movies in the collection. Don't they have
Downhill Racer? Yep.
And I think they have December.
In Blu-ray.
So I'm hoping that they're going to put out Quiz Show. Quiz Show has been out of print for years.
Oh, interesting.
It is Robert Redford directed. It's one of my favorite movies. It seems prime for the Criterion collection, be a perfect Criterion movie. So yeah, I'm going to go out on a crazy limb here. You know, there was no cartoon, I don't think, about
no drawing, about,
no
paintings,
drawings or anything like that. So, I'll go with Quiz Show. And those of you washing your dishes at home or driving in the car right now can't see this, but Mark is wearing his House t-shirt very appropriately. House. And I am wearing my Faster Pussycat Kill Kill t-shirt. And, if I were to make another wish slash prediction, I think it would be for something like Faster Pussycat to be in the collection. I think that that would be a perfect Russ Meyer in the Criterion collection would be that seems right, doesn't
it? Needs
it?
To happen.
Am I crazy?
Yeah. No, not crazy.
I've seen rumors of
it. Are you
it,
serious?
Actually. Of course, you know, there's rumors about a lot of titles. I don't know if it's how legitimate. don't get your hopes up.
Good luck with that one.
Yeah, actually, Quiz Show happens to be one of my wife's favorite movies.
Nice.
So that would be awesome. She could, you know, she likes a lot of the movies we cover, but not all. She might be more like you, Keith, likes the more accessible mainstream, but doesn't like the 5-hour Bulgarian goat movies.
Oh, all right. Yeah, sorry if it's not Scandinavian. I'm just not going to be here, I guess.
But yeah, she loves Quiz Show, so maybe she would join us if that came
out,
if we podcasted it. So maybe
two guests.
All right, so really tell us what you think is going to come out.
What do you think, Aaron?
Well, my wish slash predict wish list is always genre noir. Keith, you listen, so you know I'm a nut. La Chienne would be ideal, but anything I would take, not getting my hopes up. As far as real predictions, I'm thinking maybe it's time for Lady Snowblood. Yeah. Hmm. I think that's a possibility. Based on clues, I'd say maybe The Graduate, or actually, no, Gilda.
Sure.
And then hence The Graduate, maybe, let's see, what else was there? There's Paris Belongs to Us was teased in the newsletter. Rivette, as we mentioned. So I guess those four.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking Lady Snowblood too, Aaron. I mean, it's January. Why not get, you know, some snow in there? I'm still going to stick with, I think we need another Bergman grade. So there's still a bunch out there, Sawdust and Tinsel, Virgin Spring, the Silence of God trilogy, any one of those. And then lastly, I'll just mention, last year we got in January The Sword of Doom and The Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant. Sorry. So I'm just going to say we're going to get another Japanese title and another Fassbinder. So I'll keep it simple.
Speaking of Sword of Doom, Trevor pointed out to me that way back on the Geek Fest, we made a claim that there hadn't been a Japanese title since Throne of Blood. Well,
there
Sword of Doom.
Sword of Doom.
Oops.
another correction.
Yeah.
So we'll look forward to Thursday the 15th. And this week, as we predicted, we have a crystal ball, although we didn't get the date right. I remember Aaron said Monday and it came Tuesday. We had a flash sale, so half off all DVDs and Blu-rays, all in stock Blu-rays. We thought, I think originally Aaron had said Tuesday. We were thinking maybe, I was thinking maybe Wednesday or Thursday, and it came Tuesday. So anyway.
Oh, well.
We were close. So Aaron, what'd you get during the sale?
Everything.
You got complete.
I got the Blu-rays that I don't have. I think the new release is The Honeymoon Killers, Room with a View, and another, I forget. I got a bunch of Eclipse series, so I'm now three short of completion on the Eclipse. So, excellent. Yeah, some came Friday. The rest are coming Monday. And at some point, I'm going to get a Bagu.
Yes.
We'll see.
Yeah, some people I saw pictures posted. They got their Bagu, I think, with the order. But it looks like both of ours are shipping separately. So that's cool.
And what's weird is I ordered early. So the people that got theirs must have ordered really, really early, like the moment it was announced.
Right. So, and Keith, what did you get during the sale?
Well, because I listened to Criterion Close-Up, I ordered Moonrise Kingdom. I've got...
Bringing endorsement.
Nice.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes. I've got all Wes Anderson's movies on Blu-ray from the collection, except the ones that I already own on DVD.
On DVD,
sorry, but I'm not... There's too many... I really try to... When it comes to double dipping, I really try to... It's got to be like... There's like five titles I'll double, triple, and in a couple of cases, quadruple dip on. But for the most part, I've got them all. But since they've always come out... So really looking forward... I can't wait to see what Grand Budapest is going to look like when comes to the Criterion Collection. But Moonrise Kingdom, definitely one to own. You guys talked about the supplements on there. So supplements are great. And the commentaries sound awesome.
It is
a lot of fun.
You got to have that.
Cool.
Yeah, David would be happy. So
yes.
Well, what's funny is I actually bought Grand Budapest for $5, and I figured, you know, what's five? That's a Happy Meal. while I wait 3 years for the real thing,
right.
So
it'll be a beautiful package.
I prefer to starve. I just wait it out.
As far as the flash sale, mine was probably a little boring. I just got updated on some of the new releases for the past couple of months. So, and of course, looking forward to, I've got pre-orders in for The Brood and Mulholland Drive coming later this month. So looking forward to those.
Yeah.
So we had some sad news. Of course, we've got to talk about an important director to the collection. We had the passing this past week of Chantal Ackerman.
Yeah, very, very sad. And, not as well known as some other directors. I doubt if Keith owns any. She's not somebody I would recommend to Keith.
No, I'm sorry. I don't own any Chantal Ackerman.
It's okay.
Thanks.
She is amazing, but she is the epitome of slow, her work. John Dielman is basically a woman in a kitchen for the majority of the film. But she's an amazing director, had amazing vision. You could call her a feminist, but I call her more of a female figure, a crucial female figure in film. And I've only seen that one movie, and we studied it when I was in film class, and that was very, very enlightening. And in fact, probably without that film class, I might not have understood what she was going for. So, it is challenging. She had continued to work. Allegedly, it's a suicide. I know her last movie was not received as well, so I hopefully there wasn't. It's terrible to think that a movie doesn't go well and you lose a legend. Yeah. Really, there are a lot of tributes. I'm going to put some in the show notes. I really liked the Criterion tribute. They just put snippets of a few interviews from when they did the Jean Dielman release. So I'll put that in the show notes, but yeah, big loss. And not to use the death of a director, but I would love to see it upgraded to Blu-ray finally. Regardless of this happening, hopefully that is in the works.
Yeah, there may be. I mean, as far as the collection goes, that's the only single release. The only other thing is the Eclipse series, Chantal Ackerman in the 70s. I think there's five films in there. Right. And Keith, you're not alone. I haven't seen a single film of hers yet, so... Don't feel bad.
One thing I will point out, even a director that you might not be familiar with, it sounds like Aaron saw this in a film class, in college. So it wasn't like you were rushing out to the theater to see the latest Chantal Ackerman. And I think that's another, as we sort of praise this Criterion Collection again and again, that's the one thing is you are going to discover people that you have never heard of and movies that you've never seen and probably could have never seen otherwise. We live in amazing times. So that's what's great.
We do. Yeah. And last note on Chantal is our friend Pauline from FlixWise huge Chantel Ackerman fan, and I talked to her this week, and she was personally crushed by the loss. I almost like she lost a friend. So yeah, it's very, very tragic, and she meant a lot of things to a lot of people. So maybe one day we'll have Pauline on, and we can talk about Dielman or something else.
Sure. So. Thanks, Aaron. So a couple final news items. I wanted to mention Barcelona has been confirmed by Witt Stillman, actually just via a tweet. So his Twitter account says, ahoy to the official podcast. WB Shop no longer carries Barcelona, which means that the Criterion is near. So a little insider information. Witt is saying he knows that Criterion is going to be releasing, I believe it's 1970 film, Barcelona. It was available from the Warner Archive, and I noticed, too, it's not on Amazon anymore. So hopefully we'll see that soon.
And we talked before about this. It's been rumored a few times, and you haven't seen any of these, right?
I've seen, for Witt Stillman, I've seen Metropolitan. That's the only one I've seen.
Well, funny thing, when we were talking about this this show and this news with my wife, I thought I'd seen none, and I think I said that last week. But I actually did see Metropolitan and forgot about it.
Oh, go figure.
Andrea reminded me of the time when I saw it, and I still remember nothing about it. No. So maybe it's time for a revisit.
Yeah, I said 1970. You know, I was thinking about the score. It's a 7 on IMDb. It came out in 1994. Sorry about that. Thank you, Keith.
Oh, well, no problem.
So another news item to mention, I made a little field trip. Someone had mentioned on Twitter, I believe it was, that Criterion has come back to Costco. And lo and behold, they have, after a little hiatus. They've gotten some of the new releases. We'll embed a picture that I took from my local Costco in Vermont. They currently have for $20, Dress to Kill, Moonrise Kingdom, A Room with a View, and The French Lieutenant's Woman. So if you're still looking for those and you missed out on the flash sale and you don't want to wait till the November Criterion sale and from Barnes & Noble, there you go. So a few weeks ago, we had mentioned that Nanook of the North was out of print, which it is, but there was, from the Criterion forum, someone had emailed Criterion and got an email back from the mysterious John Mulvaney And John, of course, said that Criterion has not lost the rights to it, which kind of makes sense because it is a public domain film, and saying that there will be a new edition in the future. So that's encouraging. I guess the other thing I would say is we've heard kind of similar things regarding the BRD trilogy, the Fassbinder set, that has not come back, and that's been out of print, I think, for a couple years now. So we'll see. You know, don't hold your breath, but
we will see.
It is available currently from Flickr Alley if you want a Blu-ray copy. Of course, you can grab the out-of-print DVD.
It's also on a documentary now, but it's called Pippi Lock. And,
<That's right>. Yeah, good stuff. And lastly, we just wanted to mention there's an update from the Criterion site, Aaron.
Yeah, this is kind of a bummer for me. They've stopped selling the replacement cases for the digipacks, the thin ones. And as it turns out, I was looking for one for The Last Emperor, and I looked on the website about a month ago, and it wasn't there. And I emailed John Mulvaney, and he said, no, we don't sell it. And I figured, okay, well, I'll just wait till it comes back, and I'll buy all of them. I think there was El Norte and a few others.
Some of the out-of-print ones last year, Marion Bad, Man Who Fell to Earth, Third Man, but yeah.
Those weren't on there last time. I think The Last Metro was on there, some others. And so now they're all gone, so I don't know what the deal is.
Yeah, I think you can, if you're still looking for inserts, I think you can still order inserts, at least for in-print stuff, directly through them. I've done that before. You just send them $5. You email them, send them $5 per insert or booklet to the Criterion web store. There's a PayPal link. So if you do need some new packaging, you can do that.
And they do still sell the empty cases, just not the empty jewel or the spine
with
jewel cases.
The insert. Great. Well, so that's it for news this week. And so we're going to have just wanted to mention, as we do, we always have transitions into our segments. Next, we're going to be reviewing House. And And just to mention the transition, we're calling it the Crazy Skeleton Song. I had to go back and watch it again, because folks that have seen the movie, you'll remember it includes the refrigerator entrance, a little breaking of the fourth wall, dancing with a skeleton, and then the cat, the white cat Blanche, going forward and backward, and Auntie Manji.
Remix. It's the house remix.
Yes. So anyway, we're going to take a little break and we'll come back with House. La Welcome back, everyone, to Criterion Close-Up. Today we are going to be talking about House, and we had that lead-in. It's a little bit long, but it's a crazy House remix. We had to include it.
Meow, 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 meow.
That is Cat Aaron, for those of you who do not know.
I wear mini hats or mini cats.
I just want to mention, if there are any audio issues on Aaron's side, sorry about that. Stick with us.
My bad. First segment, I messed up, so we'll see.
So, again, today we're talking about House, or Houseu, from director Nobuhiko Obayashi from 1977. This film received very few reviews upon its initial release. Most were 10 lines or less, as Obayashi alludes to on the supplement. So I'm hoping we can do a little bit better than that today, guys. So
we got 10 lines.
We'll
in
see.
There.
You
we
got
might,
10?
Yeah.
Okay.
We might need to do 10 lines. Sorry, I'm not condoning
that would be appropriate.
Any illicit activities.
Do not try this at home. Thank you. So the original story was really, I would say, inspired by his daughter, Shimigu. She's actually on the supplements, too. The spine number is 539. Again, it's a 1977 film. It's actually an early Blu-ray release for Criterion. It came out in October of 2010. And, I mean, as far as the plot of what there is, it does follow a plot, per se, but it's about seven girls on their summer trip pay a visit to a possessed house, which plans to eat them in extremely bizarre and surreal ways.
Hmm.
And of course, our stars, the seven girls, are Gorgeous, Prof, Melody, Fantasy, Sweet, Mac, and Kung Fu. If that gives you a sense of what this how crazy this film is. And lastly, I'll just mention, you know, this movie got made because Toho, the Japanese production company, approached Obayashi with a suggestion of making a film like Jaws. So be interested to see what kind of comparison we have to
this.
This
is the company that made Godzilla.
So, yeah, and, you know, just to before we kind of get into talking about the movie, I think it makes sense to talk about how we watched this film together. Originally, Keith and I watched this, again, our very first time we'd seen it. We have a bi-weekly movie club. We get together every couple of weeks. We get together once a month sometimes and actually watch a movie together, which is great. So, and this film is really one that bears watching with a group.
Yeah. I was just going to add to that as much as we want this to be the most downloaded Criterion Close-Up episode, this is really a movie, the less you know, the better. And I talked about blind buys earlier, and this was a blind buy for me. Make it a blind buy for you. I absolutely feel like, you know, this is the Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown of Halloween movies for me now. I mean, it's just, it's a tradition right around this time of year. Got to watch House. And it is definitely a less you know movie, because there's so many surprises. But one of the things that's interesting about House is, if I tell you something that happens in it, it doesn't always ruin the surprise because you would never, ever, 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 ever guess that that would happen in a movie, period.
Or the way it happens.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. And Aaron, how was the movie? I mean, this was a first time watch for you, correct?
Yeah. And in fact, I had a very interesting experience. I watched it while my wife, Andrea, was upstairs taking a nap. I watched it by myself. Her cat was lying on the bed with her. I guess they were napping together. And I found this movie so funny that I was laughing so hard that I actually woke them up. You've heard my laugh on the cast. You know, I have a fun laugh, a boisterous laugh, but not a guffaw laugh. But I was laughing so hard at and with this movie that I was crying. And Andrea is a cat person, so I woke her up, woke her and the cat up, and I called them down to look at what was going on with the cats, especially. They were freaked out as well. So I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was exciting. I did find it to be a little crazy. So here is where the episode became lost. It is a major bummer because we had a great time discussing it. As I mentioned, Keith was phenomenal. Couldn't have hoped for a more funny, more knowledgeable, and really a guy who really got into House and saw it on multi levels. We talked about how creative it was, how fun it is to watch in a crowd. We talked about how WTF, as mentioned in the first segment, we had a way of cussing, but we would use a way to censor ourselves with House. And that worked very well. I think you'll find it was a little clever and funny in the first segment. I'm going to go ahead and play one of the clips that we did actually have in the episode, and this was some of the hippie music, which I described as being like a Mentos commercial. By Del Diego was the name of the band. And then it's followed by a person falling down the stairs. He is attached to a bucket, and he swirls like a top, bumps into a car, almost like a pinball machine, and you can kind of hear the sound effects. So this is a little long clip, but at least it's something. Again, we had so much fun recording this episode, laughed a ton. It's just such a funny episode. You'll see, we're going to put the tweets and everything in the show notes on the blog at CriterionBlues.com/podcast. So please look at it there. As far as ratings, I loved the film. I found it to be just a phenomenal experience and just joy. And again, as I mentioned, I laughed so hard that I cried. I didn't actually think it was a very good movie. I thought it was more of an enjoyable experience. So I actually gave it a 5 out of 10, which both Mark and Keith thought seemed low. Mark gave it an 8.5, and Keith gave it 25 cats, which really means 10. And we decided that even though we like this movie a lot and we think it's important, we think it's a great addition to the Criterion Collection, and we actually liked the package. We liked the supplements, especially the interview was really neat. The short was interesting. We did think that there should have been a commentary. We think that would have maybe even made it a 10 in our books. So anyway, we think House is well worth watching. Blind buy it if you don't own it. Again, apologies that we don't have a full cast for this segment. At least it's a shorter cast this week. So we're going to move on to The Shining now, and the clip that's going to introduce this last segment is Scatman Crothers, Dick O'Halloran, telling Danny about his secret power and what room to avoid.
You know, Doc, when something happens, it can leave a trace of itself behind. Say, like, if someone burns toast. Well, maybe things that happen leave other kind of traces behind. Not things that anyone can notice, but things that people who shine can see. Just like they can see things that haven't happened yet. Well, sometimes they can see things that happened a long time ago. I think a lot of things happened right here in this particular hotel over the years. And not all of them was good.
What about room 237?
Room 237?
You're scared of room 237, ain't you?
No, I ain't.
Mr. Allen, what is in room 237?
Nothing. There ain't nothing in room 237. But you ain't got no business going in there anyway, so stay out.
Welcome back, everyone. This is our third segment, and we've talked about a haunted house movie in-house, so we feel like we've got to dive into what could be the greatest haunted house, possibly the greatest horror film of all time. And I speak for some of the people who have reviewed this in the past. It really didn't get a lot of great reviews upon its initial release, but as you read about the film, it really has garnered a lot of attention and love as a great horror film, a great epic film, just for the dread that it builds. And so, we've got to dive into The Shining from Stanley Kubrick. And that clip that you heard as we led in is from Scatman Crothers as he is describing The Shining. And of course, I mentioned Scatman. He's the actor who is in the film.
Dick Halloran.
Halloran, thank you. Is describing The Shining to Danny, so kind of sets up the film.
And don't go into room 237, no matter what you do. Of course, what are you gonna do?
Right, the door's open. You're gonna go in.
Exactly. It's got that shiny key.
The plot is it's a family heads to an isolated hotel for the winter, where an evil and spiritual presence influences the father into violence, while his psychic son sees horrific forebodings from the past and the future. That's the IMDb plot. And it stars Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, Danny Lloyd, Scatman Crothers, Joe Turkel, and Philip Stone. There are a few other characters. Those are the standout ones. So this film, we felt we should really talk a little bit about how we came into this film and how it has influenced us. It came out in 1980, and I know we've all seen it and have a part of our lives, I think, in how we've grown up and kind of grown with this film, the amount of times that we've seen it. So, Keith, I'm going to kick it over to you just to talk about your experience with The Shining first.
Yeah, well, I'm really disappointed because I was told we were going to talk about The Shining.
Oh.
So I really don't have a lot to say.
Sorry.
Inside reference for those Simpson fans out there.
Google, well, we can talk about Shining, the romantic comedy trailer.
Oh, true. We could. The Shining is a favorite for me. I was I'm trying to use all my Shining lines here. Jack says that Wendy is a horror film buff or something that. I was a Stephen King buff as a kid growing up. I'm happy to be a card-carrying member of the Stephen King Book of the Month Club at one time in my life. So The Shining, I saw the movie first, before I read the book, which is, I think, will influence you, one way or the other. I've talked about this book, you guys are very nice. I sent you guys a clip. We did this as an episode of the television program I work on Vermont called Across the Fence. I interviewed a professor up here who's done a lot of work with King and is one of the foremost leading academics when it comes to making Stephen King a part of the Academy and really bringing him some well-deserved influence and reputation among, you know, the Ivory Tower and colleges and places like that. So I interviewed Tony Magistrelli for our program. He had been my thesis advisor when I was at UVM for my graduate work. And so The Shining means an awful lot to me. One of the things I find interesting about The Shining is you always hear people talk about, oh, I see something new every time I watch that movie. Mm-hmm. And that is what The Shining is for me. It's almost the text of The Shining is very simple, but the context is so deep. And I think that's one of the things that is really interesting. And one of the things that Tony brought up in our conversation was that it's the intellectual's horror film. And that sounds really bad, sounds really snobby and very elitist. But I think, you know, sort of what he's getting at is those layers, that there's a lot of things here. Apparently, there's two movies that colleges and university syllabuses always reference. And the two big ones for modern movies, of course, are The Shining and Alien. Hmm. And that there's more articles and academic papers and things written about The Shining and Alien than anything else. So just very briefly on this rewatch, so thank you again for letting me come here and talk about this and watch The Shining yet again.
Nice.
Because it is such a favorite movie of mine. One of the things that I think is very interesting in my rewatch this time was, because I am a photographer, a videographer, I pay attention to composition and how shots are composed an awful lot. And The Shining is, it's master classes, but how things are composed, of course, they use that 4:3 standard thing, which drives nerds like Mark crazy because they can't get The Shining in widescreen with their, you know, $20,000 TVs and their giant sound systems and all this stuff.
I'm fine with it for what it's worth.
Box. Yeah, exactly. Right. So you're going to watch it in a box. But everything in this movie is something we call headroom, where there's always so much headroom, this space between the top of the frame and the top of the person's head in this movie. It drives me insane. But that's very deliberate, obviously. And one of the things I love is, I love when they come into the gold room. It's the first time when Stuart Ullman is showing the Torrances around. Danny has just, the scene that you guys played, Danny's gone off and found out about what happens when someone burns toast. And you see the Torrances come in. And so it's a tracking shot where they're following the Torrances. They're coming towards the camera.
That's right.
And then the camera tracks left to right, tracks right as they walk in. So you come from this, you know, enclosed space, and then you open into this huge wide shot. And that's the one thing that's really amazing about The Shining, is there are so many wide shots. I mean, almost the whole movie is like one wide shot after another. Like, how wide can we get? But then what's beautiful is, as it's trucking left and he's talking about, you know, different things about the gold room or whatever, Dick Halloran comes into the shot, and I watched it a few times, and you can see him like in the background, just like being a background actor, and all of a sudden he comes into the foreground. And it's beautiful. No cuts, nothing whatsoever. You are implicit in the storytelling. That's one of the things that Kubrick does so well. I was watching a piece on editing a little while ago, and they talked about the scene in Dr. Strangelove, when it's got that great low angle shot of the general with the cigar in his mouth, if you know what I'm talking about. Well, that whole scene is, they said it's like 3 minutes and 45 seconds of a wide shot. And one of the things with editing that allows you to do is, you're not being told what to look at, which is what editing does. You're learning about the story yourself. And that's what The Shining really does really well as well. Is you come into that gold room shot, now you're a wide shot, Halloran comes foreground, now you're in a medium shot, they're having a conversation, there's no cutting to who's ever talking, it's just all very, very controlled. And when you're going to be that stingy with a close-up, when you go to use the close-up, you really have to sell it. And the time when he does it, he does, and it's of course in what is far and away my favorite scene of this movie, among all the favorite scenes, is when Danny first encounters the two little girls
twins
in the hallway.
Oh yeah,
that is one of my like desert island cinematic moments. I just love that moment, and that's where you see Danny close up. You actually see his head is the frame. That's it, because he's so scared and he's so involved in it.
In fact, I tweeted a bunch of pictures of Danny, which I'm going to embed in the post, and one of them was him just close up being horrified by those twins, and of course what was intercut between them. I didn't capture that the carnage.
Well, I think one of the other things that's cool about that shot, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, is again the framing is. Mm-hmm. If you go back and I totally nerded out and watched every little scene, is those girls keep moving in the hallway where they're positioned as they cut. There's a little jog of carpet to the left on the left hand side of the screen. And sometimes they're behind the carpet, sometimes they're in front of the carpet, sometimes they're standing next to it. And it's just wild the way they play with that and the thought that goes into it. And again, this is like being scared. They're totally terrifying, but you're being scared of something that you can only see at the very far end of a hallway. You know, how can you be scared of something that's that far away? Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. And one other thing I'd quickly point out that, again, I saw this time that I hadn't seen or thought about before is a lot of The Shining takes place during the day. I never really thought about that before, but that's the big thing that Texas Chainsaw Massacre always gets lauded for, is it's a horror movie not at night, but during the day.
Right.
And yes, there are scenes in The Shining that take place at night, and yes, there are scenes of Texas Chainsaw, but a lot of it takes place during the day, and you get that natural light that Kubrick loved so much. And this movie, endlessly fascinating for me. I could talk about it forever. So I want to hear what you guys have to say.
I wish we could. Wow. This could be like a two-hour episode. And speaking of the shots, and you could talk about so many shots in this movie, speaking of close-ups, the shot that I love is when Danny is riding the big wheel and the camera tracks behind him, and that's almost a close-up to the back of his head. Mm-hmm. And, of course, probably the actor, they're like, okay, drive the big wheel through the hotel. And he's like, I'm in. But it does,
easy.
The way the camera zeroed in at a low level, it does kind of put in that foreboding, that sense of dread. And of course, as we know, what he's going to encounter when he gets towards the end of the hallway, and when we do see his face, he turns around when he passes by room 237, and then we see Danny's face in close up on the big wheel, and of course, and even with the twins, he's on the big wheel. So I think it's interesting how they use the big wheel, which is a kid's plaything, and it's also a terror device, a way to encounter terror. Yeah, was that in The Shining?
The Shining.
I don't know if it's in The Shining, but it should be.
Yeah, well, and it gets to the use of sound. I mean, in that scene that you're talking about, Aaron, is that I think sound plays a lot into this movie. You know, from the use of music that is just gorgeous.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's amazing. But within that scene, you get from what I had heard from the commentary, they didn't actually realize how much sound was going to play into this shot until they heard it afterwards. Because you get the quiet when he's on the rug, and you get the loud noise of the big
hardwood
wheel
floor. Yeah.
When he's on the hardwood floor. And it's, of course, using the Steadicam. I mean, I think this is probably the film or one of the films that really, brought that to prominence. It wasn't the first use.
I believe it wasn't the first use, but it was the, they built rigs for the camera because they wanted to do this. So yeah, not the first, but they perfected it. It was perfected and really used well.
Yeah.
In this.
And yeah, you speak of the long shots, like when he's throwing tennis balls against the wall. So many of those. And actually that room is terrific for long shots. And a lot of times they establish the long shot and then they come close to the characters. So Kubrick was, we called Wes Anderson a perfectionist last week. He's got nothing on Stanley Kubrick. Oh.
No, it's amazing. I mean, you mentioned that, Aaron, I just think that in some instances, that's really where Wes Anderson is trying to get, and he doesn't do it with the 60 to 140 takes that Kubrick does, as far as we know. Mm-hmm. But his framing is very much similar. I don't know if he gives as much headspace as I had forgotten about that with as Kubrick does, but. There's certainly some symmetry there between our two episodes, but
there was a nod to Kubrick with the Midnight Sinister Coterie Intruders. I think that was a Kubrick influence.
Yeah. So. But Aaron, I mean, just to step back a little bit, I just wanted to get your kind of impressions about coming into The Shining. I think it is a horror film that we grew up with. We're all of similar age, so tell us a little bit about your introduction to it.
Well, what's funny, like Keith, I also was a Stephen King aficionado, and I think he lost me somewhere in the 90s, and no longer Actually, I did read the sequel, yeah. Doctor Sleep. In fact, if you go to my blog and do a one of the first things I wrote for the blog was not about a film, but was about Doctor Sleep. So I first watched The Shining when I was 10. And in fact, my mother just recently, I can't remember the context of the conversation, but she just said, "Man, I just wish I hadn't shown you The Shining when you were 10. And I was like, "Oh, no, Mom, it's totally cool."
I totally hear that.
I seriously could not be in a room by myself without a door open for like a week. I was so horrified by The Shining when I saw it as a kid. But and who knows, that might have contributed to my my taste. Of course, I'm into art films, but I'm also into genre films. I love horror films, especially if they're done like this. You know, maybe intellectual horror, as you said, psychological horror. And especially when they use filmic elements, mise-en-scene, these excellent camera work. But I've probably seen The Shining a dozen times. I haven't really counted. I just, every so often, that's the one I put in. But in film school, I did do a little project. I took a class called The History of Horror Film, which I thought would be... a pretty easy class. This was early in my, I think I was a freshman. I just saw, sounds like a fun class. It's actually hard as can be. And of course they took it far deeper than just, you know, what, actually we did watch Scream, but they took it far deeper than just watching slasher films. They nice. Talked about, phallic metaphors and the female's place. I won't go into that too much, but, We did a end of term project where we got to pick the film, and we could pick any of the films of the semester, and The Shining, of course, was one of those. And so I chose The Shining, and what the project was to take a shot sheet, and it was a page of actually Excel worksheet, and find any 5 minutes of a movie, and shot by shot write down exactly what happens plot wise. Right, with the sound effects, the video, write down every detail out of every frame. It was actually a daunting project when I first heard about it, but it turned out to be very exciting. And I chose the sequence where the day is Wednesday, and then you see Shelley Duvall, Wendy turning on the boilers. You know, she was really doing all the work in the hotel while Jack was writing, quote, or throwing tennis balls, or
right.
And then it goes to Danny and his big wheel and room 237, and that's the scene where the door is open. He stops on it, he looks back, and then of course the camera takes his perspective and pauses on the key, which I love that shot too. And then they cut back to the dream sequence, the nightmare. And in fact, I'll go ahead and play the nightmare if you guys don't mind.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right now.
What happened? Honey, what's wrong? Jed.
Oh, my mom. Terrible nightmare I ever had. It's the most horrible dream I ever had.
It's okay now. Really.
Well, I dreamed that I killed you and Danny. But I didn't just kill you. I cut you up into little pieces. My God, I must be losing my mind.
What is fascinating about this is that this kid has been left to his own druthers to just roam about this massive hotel. His mom is doing the work. His dad is going crazy. Meanwhile, once he's about to go into what we know as a threatening room. Of course, Scatman said don't go in there. If the parents knew about this room, they would stop it. But, and when you hear the scream, you expect it's his scream in that shot. of course, I know this sequence extremely well because I have this diligent logging of it. But then she goes, the scream she reacts to is actually her husband. So right. I had to come up with a conclusion about this. And basically my conclusion was about the feminist, or I wouldn't say feminist, but women's liberation movement of the 70s and 80s and women at work. And I had to, you know, and I used the film elements. I actually even picked up on the Apollo shirt. So we're going to mention Room 237, but through this close scrutiny, I came up with some cockamamie theories, and in fact, I'm going to try to repurpose that old paper into a blog post. Cool. I can't post the entire paper because it would just be too tedious, but I think I could edit some things out, and I'm going to try to do that later this week for you for people to read. But yeah, fascinating movie. It holds a close special place in my heart, and. And yeah, I would canonize this in a heartbeat.
Yeah, so. Probably easy. I mean, easy to canonize. Little symmetry with you, Aaron. I don't remember how old I was, but I remember I was at my uncle's house and did see it younger than I should have been. And I would say I did the same thing with some other formative films for me that were also violent in Alien and The Terminator. So you put all those movies together. Those were formative movies along with Star Wars. Of course, mm-hmm. from 1977, but again, watching these films earlier than I should have, and it still scares me. I mean, I was terrified back then. Mm-hmm. I had trouble sleeping last night after having this in the background a little bit because, you know, the from the music. I think of the music. I keep coming back to the music, and there's this one piece where it's really discordant themes in the background that really. Towards the very end in the May scene, I won't mention anymore, where they just come together to really create this beautiful, from discordant melodies to a beautiful melody, like one single note. That's what really sticks with me in this film. I mean, of course, along with the shots and the filmmaking, but it reminded me of, thinking of it last night, Under the Skin, that great soundtrack from last year, and how important sound is to music. I mean, to a film. I mean, even to tie it back a little bit to our discussion of House, we didn't really talk about this, but Obayashi had mentioned to his composer that he wanted. I mean, he said most horror films that are considered masterpieces have a great soundtrack, and that's what he wanted for mm-hmm. House. He didn't necessarily get that because you know he had some. Score pieces. There was also some of the music was made by the band Go Diego. Not Dora's brother. So you know, I just really you know love the score, and it's always. I can't remember if it was 2001, honestly, or The Shining that were the first Kubrick films for me. But I've been hooked ever since. I'd still call him my favorite director. I just love his. He's a tough guy. And you see that in the performances, but I just love his absolute attention to detail. I don't care that he went way over budget and you know knocked people off the studio lot that wanted to use it. I mean, he made to me between 2001 and really through Full Metal Jacket, masterpiece after masterpiece, and he dominated every genre that he took on. Whether he was well received early on or not well received, as this film wasn't initially, but it's come to grow in estimation. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely nailed most of what he's done. So
yeah,
it's
pretty much everything formative for me too. Everything is well received now. Even Fear and Desire, his first movie, even Killer's Kiss. But you mentioned the music, and Keith mentioned the twins. What's funny is you take the music and the soundtrack away, it's just two adorable little children. If you look at the stills, it's not very scary at all. In fact, and yeah, again, that mock trailer. Well, I think we can't take our experience away and look at it objectively. But if you just saw two twins in a hallway, you wouldn't be scared. And again, there was that mock trailer just shining. You know, they made this into a romantic comedy, and they used images from the film. And it actually, that's one of the better mock trailers, because I think it does sell itself. And I'm going to embed that as well in the post.
You basically put Salisbury Hill in anything and come up with a really good romantic comedy.
That's a good point.
One thing I think was interesting that you both brought up in the music and whatever is, you know, we talk about video I talk about video a lot of times as a team sport. Film is very much the same idea. It's the same thing.
Absolutely.
And, you know, this is a movie where all those elements hit. Everybody on the team is at the top of their game, whatever other sports cliche or metaphor you want to use. But what's also interesting is you can watch this movie with those separate elements and appreciate it just as
much. Each one, sure.
You can watch it with the volume turned down and you can still understand the story. You can watch it with, you know, doing something else and it in the background. And, you know, something about the Shining, you know, the script isn't anything that's, you know, this isn't Aaron Sorkin dialogue or whatever, but there are still things in it and things that are said and the way the lines are delivered, things that I've, pieces of dialogue that I've memorized they stick with you, and it's so memorable in almost every turn whatsoever. It's just, you know, sometimes I'll be outside with the kids and we'll be playing or something like that. I'm like, you know, what's Wendy say? Whoever gets caught has to keep America clean or whatever. I've said that to the girls a couple of times. I've said, you know, first one who gets caught gets to keep America clean, you know. So they have no idea where it's coming from, but I do. And, you know, that's a lot of fun. One quick comparison to House, to The Shining, is I mentioned in House that things are sort of, you have to accept them or they're left deliberately vague. And that's something that Kubrick understood about horror, that it's the best is what you leave out, what you don't show, or you just leave vague. I mean, it's never really understood why the Torrances are in Boulder, or you know, why Jack decides to do this or how he gets the job. And when you sort of, if that sort of bothers you, and this is sort of like a little casting before the cast of Room 237, there are answers that are left unasked, unanswered. And I think that's what one of the things that really makes this movie really strong is you realize that's not important. And I mean, talk about the Criterion being a film school in a box. The Shining is one of those movies that you don't have to go to film school. If you really watch The Shining, you can learn an awful lot of things about what makes a good movie or what makes a compelling movie. And, you know, not having all the answers sometimes is one of those answers.
What should be done with him?
I don't know.
I don't think that's true. I think you have some very definite ideas about what should be done with Danny, and I'd like to know what they are.
Well, I think maybe he should be taken to a doctor.
You think maybe he should be taken to a doctor? When do you think maybe he should be taken to a doctor?
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible.
Jack.
You believe his health might be at stake.
And speaking of ambiguity, even the power of The Shining that was introduced in, as we began the segment, even though he explains it a little bit to Danny, we have no idea what it is. Nope. We don't know what Red Rum and Tony is. And now, having read the book and the follow-up, I have an idea what was in King's head, but I have no idea. In the framework of this movie, you don't know, and that actually makes it good.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter.
Right.
You don't have to know.
Nope.
And also,
you know enough.
The third act approaches the carnivalesque. And I think you can tie in House with The Shining's third act a lot clearer. Things do go bonkers in the third act. I mean, not quite to the level that there's no torsos doing kung fu, but
sadly,
right?
Sadly,
close to it.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, you know, I think House could have used the bear man. I think he can just be. It's a bear. I know Mark's friend Josh Larson and his masters at Film Spotting. Disappointed about they don't know it's a dog or a bear. It's a
dog,
bear.
Rabbit, whatever.
It's a rabbit,
bird,
oh, rabbit.
Maybe. I think
okay.
They said rabbit.
Oh, they say rabbit. It's a bear.
Remember, according to Michael Phillips from Film Spotting, this is minor Kubrick, but that's a whole nother discussion.
Ouch!
Right.
Ouch!
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry, Michael.
Right. Just throwing that in there.
That's right.
Not on board.
Yeah, I was more upset that he didn't know what the
bear was. Right, but
or what the bear was doing.
Right.
It's also very important.
It is. Yeah. Well, and it's a good point. I mean, you mentioned the bonkers aspect of it, but and you talked about the horror too. There isn't a lot of horror in this film. I mean, this film builds dread from the opening scene with the music and the helicopter shot. It's one big, you know, two-hour dread sequence, and then, you know, you get the payoff at the end. And there are some instances where I'd question if, you know, the, again, not spoiling, but there's a scene with the skeletons, you know, if that necessarily works, if that really needs to be there. But,
I can talk about that scene at the end there when the hotel, you know, really sort of starts to show everything. I think you've already seen all the scariness. So when you get to sort of those very boring, dull, you know, bunch of skeletons, what's that about, you know? To me, it's, I never think about the skeletons. I think about Shelley Duvall running her Shelley right, Duvall right. arms
with her knife in hand the entire time.
And another thing about that too is when she goes up the stairs before she sees the bear is that's a total lift right from Nosferatu. I mean, I never saw it before, but you see her shadow coming up the stairs just like
it's a lovely, lovely shot where, I mean, it's Steadicam again. I noted that. And the camera is in front of her and follows her as she's going up the stairs. It's gorgeous.
And you also don't really know that these things are real. I mean, she's experienced the horror firsthand, and this could be an unreliable narrator thing. Her going bonkers through the house and seeing man bears and skeletons could be just the metamorphosis of all this horror that she's feeling. And, you know, I don't want to go too far into the ending.
Yeah, I mean, the entire film is really could be seen as one unreliable narrator after another. I mean, we don't know what's going on, who's right, who's following what. I mean, you get in each character's head to an extent, but really more what they're seeing, not what they're actually feeling, you know, other than what they say.
Deliberately vague.
Exactly.
And it is scary. And you mentioned how just the little things, even the title cards, the way they just force themselves on the screen, boom, out of nowhere, it's Wednesday.
Or
it's
Saturday.
I'm so scared of a Wednesday.
I know. I mean, Chaplin could not pull that off.
Well, and I mean, you talked about the camera work too. I mean, that the title card reminds me of just the use of deep focus in many of the shots, like the shot that Keith was talking about in early on in the hotel. But then the, I think we call it shallow focus, where that scene where it's iconic, and I wonder how many, at what point in the filming it was at, where you see Jack and he's just sitting there and nothing else is in focus. It's just him. You know, and you think he's probably watching the family. I mean, it's, and that's one of those shots where you just get that, almost like a jump scare with, hey, it's Wednesday, like you were talking about. It's just a great, great shot.
Is that the one where he has that pale face and it just,
he's standing in front of the windows.
Kind of, his chin first, is down. And
the first really indication that he's really losing it is that one shot. And all you need is one image to develop, an arc really. So.
A little slow tonight, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Torrance. What'll it be?
I'm awfully glad you asked me that, Lloyd, because I just happen to have 220s and 210s right here in my wallet. I was afraid they were going to be there till next April. So here's what. You slip me a bottle of bourbon, a little glass, and some ice. You can do that, can't you, Lloyd? You're not too busy, are you?
No, sir. I'm not busy at all.
Good man. You set him up, and I'll knock him back, Lloyd, one by one. White man's burden, Lloyd, my man. White man's burden.
Right.
Well, can we talk about the elephant in the room?
Yes.
The elephant in the room being room 237.
Yes.
That's a scary room, man.
That's a scary room. Well, I'll lead off here. So if folks haven't seen this, it's a documentary about The Shining and sort of the fandom and theories that have tried to fill in some of those spaces that have been left deliberately vague. You know, Dick Halloran sort of says it right. There ain't nothing in room 237. You know, so stay out.
Nothing. There ain't nothing in room 237. But you ain't got no business going in there anyway. So stay out.
It's an interesting... I liken the movie to, like, I don't know, walking past a dead animal on the road. I can't quite get the right metaphor here, where you shouldn't look, but you do.
You're fascinated,
You're fascinated. I've seen it. There's a lot of crazy theories that people have. Oh, I shouldn't say crazy. That's not fair. Well, there's a lot of personal theories.
Yeah, personal is a good word.
Personal is a good word.
Are you saying that Kubrick did not film the moon landing?
well, that's one theory, that it's an apology for the moon landing.
Right.
That for his involvement in faking the moon landing. Right. That it's all about the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. That it is the one thing that I find fascinating about room 237 is it talks about the architecture of the Overlook, which I think is probably the best part of that movie, and how nothing connects. And again, that's just a brilliant genius kind of move to create a movie about a hotel in which nothing fits. Stuart Ullman's room has a window in it when it's supposed to back the elevators. That doesn't make any sense, and it's a maze, and everything is a maze. Again, watch it with the very slightest grains of salt, but it's worth something to watch. And yes, if you do feel that the sweater that someone wears is an indication that the director therefore is apologizing for faking the moon landing, it's your own trip.
And the film gets you thinking about what your own kind of theories. I think on one hand it almost fails because early on it gives you so many ideas, and by halfway through of it I'm kind of sick of hearing other people's ideas, but at least it might give you a kind of a kick in the butt to think about your own theories about the film. You mentioned the themes of Native Americans, of course. Stephen King loves his things that are built on Indian burial grounds. So he keeps coming back to that. That's a Stephen King theme, but you could say that Kubrick is picturing this as a hey, sorry to Native Americans, and back to the scene of the blood in the elevator. A lot of pieces kind of tie into that. I know it's talked about in
Some things that are there that I think Kubrick is definitely making a comment on. But I think the other thing that Room 237 really talks about and does well, I would argue, is it talks about fandom. It's no different than the movie Trekkies, if you ever watched Trekkies.
Right.
And, there's no reason that a dentist should have his dentist practice look like the control room to the Starship Enterprise. But there it is. And I think it's the same thing here. And to me, Room 237, it exploits some of these people and some of their ideas in some ways.
Sure.
But, I feel better for... I'm glad I saw it. And I guess I'm also glad that I know that it's a Playboy that Jack reads in the...
Playgirl.
In the reception. Right. Playgirl. Sorry, yeah, Playboy. Oh, God, that'd be way too...
You need to watch The Shining again.
That's right, I need to watch The Shining again. Yeah, that's a Playgirl that Jack's reading, and all that means, that he's reading a Playgirl for all the homoerotic tendencies that the movie... It's so obviously there, in the movie.
Well, right. I actually was a big fan of 237, but not that I give credence to the majority of the theories, but... Just that, like you said, every time you watch this film, you do pick up on something new. And, I've watched it, I said, a dozen or so times.
Yeah.
But if that were 100, 200, and if I had done, like I mentioned, that shot project, if I had done that for the entire movie, and even that five-minute project, I did come up with some stuff that was clearly not intended. I think that's kind of the purpose of, English class does close readings like this.
Right.
You're trying to pick up not really author's intent, but just deconstructing the art, and so I think that's really what the fandom has done. They've looked at it too closely, taken these things, and whether the hotel connects is intentional or not, it may be because he was so meticulous. It may have just been production. Maybe they just didn't have a good continuity person. it's possible. As for the other, they're crazy theories, and I didn't give any credence to them, but I still was hypnotized by watching and trying to see the justification through the film and the clips of how they explain these cockamamie theories.
Sure, so, I mean, yeah, it's interesting to hear how someone's passionate about something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fanboys talking about something is certainly interesting. But so, in kind of to start wrapping up, as we were thinking about talking about, we always have a subtopic on Criterion Close Up, and of course, tying into House would be to talk about haunted houses. But really, turned into, instead of talking about separate movies, this longer discussion about the Shining, of course, one of the most iconic haunted house movies. And so we wanted to just mention briefly a few others that might be important. So I'll turn it over to Keith.
Oh, thanks. When you guys were beginning to talk about this and offering up haunted house movies, one of the movies that I watched for this was The Haunting, which is based on The Haunting of Hill House. Mm-hmm. Probably the best haunt, you know, the most iconic haunted house movie, directed by Robert Wise. His follow-up to West Side Story, because of course,
why not?
And also written the original movie, original book, novel, The Haunting of Hill House, written by a Vermonter, Shirley Jackson. So that's really good. And one other I would point out really quick, and when I brought this up, you guys were really game for it, and I was like, oh, doesn't everybody just think of this movie as that? Is Alien. Mm-hmm. Alien is a haunted house movie in space. Two haunted house movies to watch. Alien, because obviously everybody knows that.
Right, of course.
And The Haunting.
Well, the argument about haunted house movies is you can't, you know, everybody says, well, why don't you just leave? Well, with Alien and The Shining, you can't leave. With The Haunting and with House, actually.
You can't leave.
I would have left with the watermelon scene. I thought of The Innocents is a good one, and that's a good Gothic Victorian example, and a brilliant movie. Jack mm-hmm. Clayton, and I could see us talking about that someday. There's also, I think there's still it's still fresh material. They're still coming out with haunted house movies. The Conjuring was one that came out last year that I thought was pretty good. I don't rank it up with the movies we've seen so far, but I think for modern film, it's pretty good. Right. Just the other day, I watched a movie called We Are Still Here, which I actually didn't like, but I saw was pretty well received by critics. So I don't recommend that one, but there's plenty.
Yeah, I would mention The Others. That's a good one with a really good ending and reveal. Great performance from Nicole Kidman. That's a, you know, somewhat newer. And, you know, we talked about some of the Japanese horror films. There's been remakes like The Grudge, I thought was one of the better ones. The Orphanage is another one actually produced by Guillermo del Toro. Pretty solid. And I've got to mention, really, the first, I wasn't a big fan of horror comedies until I saw the original The Evil Dead. That's a haunted house film. I mean, they're stuck there. They go to this this building and find the Book of the Dead. That's a good one. And, you know, recently, I'll just mention The House of the Devil. That's from Ty West, who was on the supplement for House. It's another a slow burn, but one of my favorites horror films of the past few years. Really good stuff. So, anything else to mention about The Shining? I think we covered The Shining, Room 237, and Haunted Houses.
I could keep going for hours, guys, but we better stop.
Orders from the house. We should probably
wrap it up. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening, and we really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed the discussion of two important haunted house movies. And thank you, Keith, for joining us again on your birthday. It's great to have a live guest here.
Thanks,
finally.
Keith.
So where can folks find you online, Keith?
Online, you can find me on my blog, which is Interested in Sophisticated Fun, and also on Twitter at Keith PM Silva.
Thank you. Aaron?
I am AWest505. My blog is CriterionBlues.com, which is also our podcast, which is still confusing.
All right. And you can find me. I'm Mark Herney. It's at Mark Herney, MarkHurne on Twitter, and also on Letterboxd, MHURNE. And you can find the show at Criterion Close Up. It's at Criterion CU on Twitter. And please email us any feedback you have at feedback@CriterionCloseUp.com. We also just want to mention we've gotten some more iTunes reviews. We love seeing them. So, you know, keep them coming. We also love the feedback. We've seen some feedback about how folks are following along with the show. I think that's great. I love, so, you know, if you're following along, watching a movie, you know, definitely send us your thoughts on Twitter email, any of the social medias. And finally, just a little preview for next week, Aaron.
Well, we're going to have January releases, so we'll see what those are, and we'll chat about those, and hopefully we'll have seen them this time. We're also going to have a guest, Christina from Speakeasy, and she's going to talk about the classic blogosphere, and we've kind of already started fleshing this out, but we're going to talk about TCM Fest, talk about some of these little classic blog organizations, social media. So it's going to be a little different world, I think, to you and to a lot of other people, but I think it's going to be a good conversation.
Cool. Oh, looking forward to that. Another Criterion Close-Up episode. So thanks, everyone, for joining, and we'll catch you next time.
All right.
House.
House.